I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program is from the Morning Show Archives. It is, of course, a very special pleasure, privilege, thrill, frightening experiences to be speaking with a luminary from National Public Radio like Scott Simon. And he is well known to so many of you, I'm sure, for his quarter century of hosting NPR's Weekend Edition. And in fact, longtime listeners to WGTD might even remember that well over 20 years ago, Scott Simon actually paid a visit to WGTD during one of our fall fundraisers. And in addition to his superb work over the air, Scott Simon is responsible for a number of very, very fine books. The novels Pretty Birds and Windy City, the memoir Home and Away, and Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball, and in a very, very personal and insightful new book called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption, in which we learn of the experience which Scott Simon and his wife Carolyn had in adopting two spectacularly beautiful little girls from China. And this is a book not only about that, but of the experiences of others who have either adopted or been adopted, and woven together all kinds of remarkable insights on what it means to be human, what it means to be a parent, the connection that we have with one another. And I can say, as someone who's not a parent, not adopted, or in no way sort of in the bullseye of this topic, that this book is one of the most interesting and moving books I've read in a long time.
Oh, thank you.
Scott Simon, we welcome you to the morning show. It's a delight and pleasure to speak to you. I will try not to dangle my participles or split my infinitives as
I do that all the time, and boy, don't our listeners let you know about it, too.
I wonder if we could just spend, I assure you, just a very brief time, a minute or two, just talking about how satisfying you find your work with National Public Radio, and in particular, what it is that has drawn you to and essentially keeps you grounded in the medium of radio.
Well, you know, I think it's less the medium of radio, I must say, than it is just the way NPR does radio. I think is very satisfying to those of us who are blessed enough to have had careers there. There's a terrific amount of repertorial freedom. There's a terrific amount of creative freedom. Really, the only, you know, all jokes aside, the only thing that anybody cares about is doing a good story. And there's a terrific latitude that you can use in terms of creative techniques and approaches to do that, even though, you know, the audience over the past 25 years has grown to almost 30 million listeners to NPR nationwide. And it's very satisfying because it's, you know, it's an audience and yet not just an audience. Over the years, I think it's safe to say that NPR listeners have become, to use that terribly overworked word, a community. They have become individuals that really share a singular experience, a large group of individuals who share a singular experience, and I think are themselves adventurous in the kinds of knowledge that they want to receive. You know, so much of the information world, and I think this is really important nowadays, so much of the information world, what we call media, is literally divided. You now reach whatever conclusion you think you want, and then you can find a news service that will tell you that you're right. The thing that I really treasure about NPR is that they don't pander. I mean, we're entertaining. I shrink sometimes when we were asked to record fundraising announcement that you use the word like intelligent or something. We are, I hope. But on the other hand, you know, we're also very entertaining, and which is why I love to talk to people who don't necessarily fit, I think, the stereotype out there, the profile of an NPR listener. They're people who are just interested in ideas, interested in people, and interested in being exposed to the wider world. And just the opportunity to do that at NPR has been unrivaled.
One of the people you talk to in the course of your book is your NPR colleague, Steve Inskeep, who is, of course, one of the hosts of Morning Edition. In a very brief interview I got to do with him, I think on his first anniversary on the job, I said something in a question about what is it about radio you enjoy in terms of it not having pictures? I mean, is there something about the lack of pictures that excites you and poses satisfying challenges? And he just jumped right and said, oh, but there are pictures.
Yeah.
And of course, then went on to say what, of course, anybody who listens to NPR knows, which is that it is amazing how vivid a picture can be created simply through the world of sound and words.
Yeah, and I think it engages people in a way sometimes other media doesn't. It stays with them. I'll leave it to physiologists to explain some of what's going on there, but I think it just hits the mind and sits in the mind in a different way than pictures, which can be superficial. I don't happen to believe a picture is worth 1,000 words. I mean, it depends. You know, you can cram an awful lot into 1,000 words that are very worthy, which is not to in any way decry the value of pictures, or for that matter, print. But I think radio is a wonderful medium for both combining kind of the resonance of thought and the singularity of a single human vision with the immediacy of broadcasting, which is obviously another thing that we offer.
Mm. We're speaking with Scott Simon. I feel like that's one of the more pointless introductions I've ever made in my long history with this program. Surely everybody listening to the morning show today knows that I'm speaking with Scott Simon, just that unmistakable voice. And we are talking, however, not about NPR today so much as we are talking about Scott Simon's new book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption, which in large measure is the story of the experience of he and his wife adopting two beautiful girls from China, and woven together with the reflections and really remarkable insights of a number of different people who either have adopted or been themselves adopted. I wonder, Mr. Simon, if you could talk about what it felt like to craft a book that was so exceptionally personal, and if... for as I'm sure as exciting as that had to be, was there anything remotely unsettling about penning this kind of intensely personal book?
You know, I have to say, you know, unless I run into something down the line, not really a lot. I mean, there were some things I just knew that we wouldn't go into, but nothing important. I was aware of the fact that her children are going to grow up reading this book. So I always tried to keep that in mind. But on the other hand, we're very open with our children. And the fact that we're very open with our children about how they came to be part of our family and we became the people who look after them and love them above all others on this earth, we're very open about that. And that there's no way of just keeping that inside the confines of the family, nor why should you want to. There's nothing shameful about it at all. In fact, there's something joyful and blessed about it. So we're very open with our youngsters, and that, you know, includes being open in the outer world to talk about it. So really, it wasn't that bad. There is, and this might be on your mind, what I hope I kind of mostly play for laughs, although there's a serious point at the end. There is a section on infertility. And that's a rough thing for a lot of families to contend with. Absolutely there is. But that's why I thought it was important to do it. That's why I thought it was important to tell that side of the story, and I play it for laughs in terms of my own experience, but obviously for families that are going through infertility, that can be a real problem because you do feel as if somehow you have failed the person in your life that you love most.
Are you...
I just thought if the book was going to be honest, I had to put that in there. But as I say, I mean, it's mostly a funny section where I wind up acknowledging the obvious. So I can't say that there was a lot, and neither for the dozen other families with whom we spoke. I mean, Steve Inskeep, Frank DeFord, Alexander Julian, the fashion designer, Jeff Seller, the Broadway producer, Steve Levitt, the University of Chicago for economics professor. All of them have different adoption stories. And I said to all of them, look, I'm grateful that you agreed to speak with me for publication. These are all people to one degree or another that I knew beforehand. And I want you to know, since I'm aware of the fact that, you know, it's I'm not going to approach this as a traditional journalist. If there's something you don't want me to go into, I won't. And then I'll have to decide whether or not it's worth including your story in the book. And, you know, none of the people with whom I spoke wanted to leave out any of the important stuff. Not at all. Because I think the important stuff to us is something that we're proud of.
And not to get too specific yet, but one thing I appreciated is that these various stories are not included, in your words, to tell any kind of particular story or to make any particular point about adoption. I mean, it seems that you went looking for whatever kind of experiences they had had about adoption. You write, the stories I share from other families are not meant to prove anything in particular.
You know, it's not because, I mean, I don't, on the one hand, I don't, I mean, I've got nothing, the only thing I want to prove is hardly the word, but, you know, what I hope people, if they read the book, which I think of as first and last, a series of love stories, I mean, a series of romances, as to how people find each other, fall in love, and make their way in life with each other, make their way through life with each other. But I do want to open a window into adoption. I want to de-traumatize it for people on the outside, maybe who don't understand it. And I also want people to understand that it is as natural as childbirth. I mean, like childbirth, it begins with an act of love. It literally transforms your flesh and blood. And I think it's been going on almost as long as childbirth. I mean, this to me was a bit of an eye-opener, although kind of modern legally regulated adoption is relatively new. Very ancient accounts you read about people picking up children who have been left behind. Sometimes even, by the way, children of enemies that they had smited, or whatever the biblical term would be. You know, when Pharaoh's daughter lowered her arms down into the bulrushes, that was a little baby wrapped in a Hebrew blanket. She didn't think it was a member of the Egyptian royal family, yet she raised him as a member of the Egyptian royal family. Tolstoy, Steve Jobs, William Tecumseh Sherman, John Lennon, whose 70th birthday we are in so many ways observing around this time, were all adopted. This has been going on for centuries, and it's not a trauma. It's something joyful, and I think people who are adopted and the families who adopt them are really nothing but blessed.
You begin the book with this simple, profound sentence, adoption is a miracle. And you go on to say that what makes it a miracle is its inexplicability. I wonder if you could share with us what you find most inexplicable about adoption.
Well, you literally hold that child in your arms when you, in case of our, we received two daughters in China, one of the adoptions that are one, in fact, at our hotel room in Nanchang. And literally you fall in love at that moment, which and that only deepens as you go along. But you can literally feel your heart reforming and new chambers forming in your heart and the flow of your blood being rerouted and out of yourself so much and into that child that you hold in your arms. I mean, it literally is a transforming miracle that way, to have that child placed in your arms and know you're to look out for them in life is transforming. It's revolutionary in, I think, the real sense of that very overworked world. Now, as I think I also say in the book, it's not as if you know, when you become a parent, you immediately stop trying to stay up late and be cool and tell naughty jokes and all that sort of thing. But you are literally sobered with the fact, as you hold that child, that you have become responsible for their welfare on this earth. Hmm. And the love that you can feel flowing out of you into that child is something absolutely transforming. It absolutely reconfigures what's important to you in life. And, you know, as my mother said once, it makes you less frightened of death because we know the story doesn't end here.
Your story of adoption actually has an interesting first chapter of sorts, a moment in the nation of Ethiopia. And I wonder if you would share with our listeners this very powerful moment and to what extent it resonates with what you and your wife ultimately decided to do.
Well, you know, I was in Ethiopia covering what was then the civil war and famine in that country, and we went to an orphanage. There were lots of youngsters who had been orphaned and or abandoned, really for a generation in Ethiopia. And they were all little boys in white shirts, and just called out something within me. I began to pick them up. I began to hoist them on my shoulders. I began to hold them. I began to kiss them. And these were little boys who had been surviving, living, you know, one of the very good church-run orphanage. As my wife says, there are orphanages that they have enough resources. There's enough food for the youngsters. There's enough clothing. They might be warm enough, but they're no happy orphanages. And these are youngsters who had just been longing for a human touch, and I happened to be the human being who walked in that day and began to give it to them. And we just spent the day hugging and kissing and rolling around on the ground and holding them. And when I went to sleep that night, I literally felt an ache for their, you know, their little heads against my shoulders. And it was, I think, one of the first times I began to think that I really want to be a father. I really want to look out for someone in this world. Hmm.
As you and your wife realized your situation, before we get into that, because I find myself hesitating how to frame this question, it brings to mind the fact that you talk in the book about how some of the challenges involving language are really exquisitely difficult. You write, "Writing about adoption is fraught with opportunities for people to take offense." Can you just say a word about that? Because I suspect that weighed very heavily on you as you put words on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a rhetorical minefield when you try and do it, because people do not like the phrase, for reasons I understand, "his adopted child." So you have to say his child who is adopted. Even though I think the majority of people that encapsulate an observation like that certainly don't mean to be offensive, you have to use a phrase like, has an adoption plan, which I think is I don't mind saying ludicrous when applied to a young woman in China, scared young mothers in China, who have to give up their children because they know they can't. No, they can't keep them under the law because of China's obnoxious state family planning policies and specifically the one-child policy. And without meaning to, you can say something that absolutely inflames people because a lot of them know the two or three phrases that most offend them, and so that's what they're kind of loaded with a baseball bat ready to swing out at. But when you're certainly writing a book that touches on adoption, you have to phrase different situations in maybe 100 different ways. So it's a minefield.
Right.
I mean, knock wood, so far it's been okay.
Good. And so far, I hope okay with our interview. The question I'm framing in my mind is something to the effect that when you and your wife
discovered that the traditional Abraham and Sarah begetting manner wasn't working.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yes right, exactly.
When you knew that was appearing to not be a feasible option for you, and then you began to consider adoption, you shared with us some really interesting reasons why ultimately international adoption became your choice, and also why China ultimately was the most attractive option. Speak about both of those important choices that you and your wife made.
Yeah, and you know, I should explain that circumstances change, I think, from year to year. I certainly have heard, just since I've been making appearances with this book, from a lot of families who will fill in the blanks about why it can be daunting to adopt domestically. In our particular case, like Frank DeFord talks about in his case, I was already over 40. My wife is not yet there. And many domestic adoption authorities prefer to give preference to younger parents. So we would have been at the back of the line. And this creates things, which is not to say that maybe we wouldn't have had a child in our arms in 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years, but who could say? There was an anxiety about that. There are also other international programs. In fact, we looked at Ethiopia. That was the first program at which we looked. And the good news at that particular point for Ethiopia was that there weren't that many children that were available, so there was a long waiting list. Now, by the way, Ethiopia has a more active program than it did then. China had the most expeditious program going. They said that once you were approved, you could have a baby in your arms within 9 months. And given the fact that we had already spent 2 years trying to start a family, that sounded very good to us. Now, of course, China, altogether different. In fact, I'm doing this interview with you from Boulder, Colorado. I met a family last night at one of my appearances that said that they were approved. They got, I guess, what's called their authorization in 2006. So they have already been waiting for 4 years, and let's figure another year where they went through the paperwork. So they've been waiting for 5 years for a child from China. Now, had that been the case when my wife and I were adopting, we would not have adopted in the Chinese program. But at that particular point, it seemed the most expeditious. And, you know, you also look for signs. I'm not sure I can explain that. But you look for kind of the universe to arrange itself in such a way that a cloud will open and it will reveal your path to you. And in our case, my wife and I, who had a stunningly quick courtship, had fallen in love in Chinatown in New York. She had an apartment on Mott Street. And somehow that seemed to fit.
One of the things that is endearing about your story, and in some respects even encouraging, I suppose, is that your story of, particularly with your first daughter you adopted from China, is not exactly a story of love at first sight as far as she was concerned.
No, absolutely not. Goodness gracious. Well, we were put into her arms. The only world that she had known, she's 11 months old, of course, had been in that orphanage, in that institution. And we know it was cold. We know that she was fed according to a rigid schedule. We know that she was never held, kissed, all of that stuff that simply the numbers make it impossible to do in orphanages. But it was the only world that she knew, and she was understandably anxious. And suddenly there's these two big adults all over her and were kissing her and were holding her and were cooing to her. Our little girl, Elise, talking about oldest daughter, her Chinese name is Feng Xiaomei, which is now her middle name. So we would kind of stand on either side of her, my wife and I, and try and to persuade her that we were on her side, and we would chant, Feng Xiaomei, Feng Xiaomei, Feng Xiaomei. And for 2.5 days, she cried. She cried inconsolably. She was crying so much, only pausing to come up for air so that she could eat. I really thought the little tears on her little face was turning so red and so hot. I thought the tears would kind of break into droplets of steam. And then, after 2.5 days, and not long after we gave her a bath, which she rather decided that she liked, I don't know. She just, as Steve Levitt, the Freakonomics professor, says in the book, children are not only, and she was 11 months at that point, remember, children are not only amazingly absorbent and remember things, they also have a genius for forgetting what they don't need to survive. And I think after 2.5 days, she had just determined that we were there, that we were her ticket in life, and we were the folks to whom she'd been given in the universe at this particular point, and we seemed to be doing okay by her, and so that was okay with her. And then that's you see the incredibly infectious smile that's on the cover, the cover photo of my wife holding up Elise. That's when the giggles and the laugh began to come, the sweetest sound in the world.
Mm. Against that backdrop is, of course, the very sobering, actually tragic reality of life in China and how baby girls have been regarded there. And I appreciate the fact that that in your book you squarely confront this reality, which you say, express it at one point this way: it is impossible, it is irresponsible to forget that our daughters are blessings that began with a crime.
Yeah. Well, and the crime, I think, is China's one-child family policy. And look, let me say, my wife and I did not think that China's state planning of the family policies were so reprehensible. We set out to adopt two little girls from there to somehow rescue them from that. That wasn't the case at all. As I said, China just had the most expeditious program going at the time we were adopting. But now that we have adopted two little girls, they are from China, and we are a half-Chinese family. So my wife and I are obliged to find out about this, and even obliged to feel strongly about this. The life of little girls who are abandoned in the countryside is too terrible for us to contemplate. Now, it's not the lives our little girls are going to have, but these are not the lives of the people that you can see in occasional television profiles of Chinese millionaires or billionaires, and lots of accomplished people who are doing things in China. These are little girls who, had they not been adopted, would have been had no particular childhood, would have been forced into farm or factory work by the age of 11 or 12, simply slotted there. That's what they do with the manpower that they have in the orphanages in China, or sometimes worse. And the worst really is too terrible to contemplate, where they might have wound up, if I might say it delicately, in a life of servitude to men. And I don't want this to hang heavy on our daughters' heads. They are, if anything, spoiled kids. And I can say that because I'm the spoiler in chief. They want for nothing in particular in their lives. Although, as Elise said the other day to my wife, I would like a dog. But that's about at the level of want that they have. But I do hope that at some point our youngsters, and I can even see that beginning to develop now, will be the kind of human beings who will wonder what kind of lives youngsters that might have been in cribs on either side of them in their orphanages had. I want them to have that sense of conscience and that kind of character. And I hope my wife and I are doing that.
I wonder if you would share with our listeners a very poignant moment in which you are putting Elise to bed on a very cold night in Chicago. She's about 2 years old at the time, and she apparently had kind of kicked the blankets off, and so she calls out, "Code, Mama, code." And
code, Mama, code.
Yeah, and, of course, your wife comes running to put her in under the blankets again. You write, "Our baby huddled and shivering, calling out for her mother's touch, trusting that all she had to do was call and her mother would be there." But then you tell us about some time ago when a really almost kind of heartbreaking little conversation occurs between your wife and Elise.
My wife was putting her to bed, and in a very matter-of-fact way, Elise looked up and said, "When my mother left me, was I cold?" And, you know, that's just a devastating question to hear. And I think what happens is that, you know, children, understandably, are curious, and they fill in the blanks about what their experience was, might have been. And my wife told her what we know, that she was found, she was clean, wrapped in warm clothing, and left in a bundle in front of a light bulb factory, where she was meant to be found, and that she was wrapped very tightly and was clearly, had been cared for, had clearly been loved. And my wife said, "No, darling, you were not cold. Your mother loved you very much, and she put you in a place where she knew you would be found, and she made certain that you were not cold." You know, and I refer to it as a devastating moment, but it's a very healthy question to ask. I think this this displays a young woman in our now 7-year-old who has a very healthy understanding of her origins in life and curiosity about it, and yet at the same time understands that it is somehow not a wound to be absorbed or gotten over. It's just a circumstance. We all have these circumstances, and we learn from them, and we grow stronger, and we get better as we grow up.
This also speaks to what you said earlier in the interview, that you really try not to think of either of your two daughters as rescued children, although I'm sure one of the challenges of that is that probably a lot of people out in the world are tempted to think of them in that way.
Well, you know, yes, and meaning only to be nice, I must say. That's the case. I mean, there's a woman who works at the food service at NPR, and when I bring our daughters in, they are incredibly cute and adorable, and so she was making a big fuss over them, and she made them a huge pile of food, which she brought over for breakfast as we were having there in the cafeteria. And then she said, as we sometimes hear, your daughters are so beautiful, and you know, they could almost be Chinese. And I laughed and said, as a matter of fact, they are Chinese. And she said, oh, but your wife's not Chinese. And I said, yes, no, that's true. She's French. And she wondered, you know, how did that happen? And I said, well, we adopted them. They were in orphanages, and we adopted them. And her eyes just filled with tears. And, of course, she did what I think any natural parent will do. She began to fill their plates with even more food. As if, you know, you could make up for it in that particular moment. Things like that, I think, what they happen at that level are just absolutely fine. But I don't want our daughters growing up thinking that they have a big thing to get over, some kind of the circumstances of how they came to us represent some kind of trauma that they must spend the rest of their lives recovering from, because I don't think that's true at all. And I also don't want them to think that somehow the way they began in life is any kind of permanent disadvantage. I mean, is it a tough way to begin in life? Absolutely. But I think by the time most of us are in our late teens, we've suffered some kind of losses, deaths, people close to us, perhaps even our parents, as I did, some kind of illness, some kind of tragedy from which we have to bounce back. And, you know, it's that experience that absolutely makes the heart resilient.
Sure, it's one of many wounds or many losses that we are bound to experience as human beings.
Exactly, and I think our daughters just had one big fat obvious one at the very beginning of their lives, but they seem to be doing pretty well now. And you know, I think it's also important for my wife and I as parents to let them be children, to also not treat them as they're somehow rescued children, because we don't want them to have a sense of gratitude to us. I mean, for one thing, you know, the gratitude is all in the other direction. We thank them for being the blessing of our lives. I do think they could be a little bit more conspicuously thankful to their mothers for all that my wife does for them. You know, I mean, I don't think it would hurt them to say, oh, mother, this was a very delicious, nutritious breakfast. Thank you so much for taking such good care of us, instead of, I don't want pancakes again. But that being swept aside, I want them to be able to grow up normally, to push back, to rebel, to tell us that we're, you know, to tell me specifically that I'm an idiot, I don't really understand them. I actually look forward to the day that at some point they'll say, why did you take us out of the fastest expanding economy in the world and bring us to this industrial backwater? I mean, I think that'll mean that they're thinking for themselves and standing on their own 2 feet. And they have to be free to grow up without any kind of sense of gratitude to us.
By the way, I just want to mention to our listeners that there's quite an extensive discussion in the book on observations made by author Nancy Verrier in a well-known book called The Primal Wound, in which she suggests that really anybody adopted is beginning life with a very particular kind of wound from which, in a sense, they never fully recover. And one of the things I think is so intriguing about how you talk about this is that although you pretty much disagree with that point, that she makes. You say at one point, but I try to listen, because you find that there are other things she says that for you ring more true. But
well,
I appreciate
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and I, you know, and I think. I think that phrase is unfortunate in some of the reasoning that surrounds it. But, you know, Nancy has had, she does an awful lot of good for many people, particularly as a family therapist. And she just has an awful lot of experience talking to people. And I think a lot of her prescriptions are in fact, very, very valuable, that we always have to be sensitive, especially in families touched by adoption, to, for example, to be sensitive for... We want to make certain our youngsters aren't just trying to please us, and so therefore, if they show talents in a direction that's nowhere reflected in our family line or interest in something that in no way reflect ours, we have to be sensitive enough to pick up on that and help them. And had she just maybe not referred to it as a primal wound, but simply said, this is you know, I think I have some fun with it in the book. I say, well, I think I suffered a primal wound when I wasn't born as Warren Buffett's son. But I do agree that it, you know, it might be some kind of sensitivity at certain times in one's life. Hunger can be a trigger example for kids who've been in institutions, because they're used to fending for themselves when they're, even when there's enough food in an institution. They're used to kind of, you know, they're fed according to a schedule, not according to when they're hungry, especially when they're young. And that's not the kind of attention a baby should receive. So while they're growing up, hunger can be a kind of trigger. And when they become hungry, a youngster who spent formative months not being able to react like a child, but in an institution and missing the one-to-one love of a parent, won't get hungry and say, well, I've got every flavor of yogurt stick in the world in the freezer. They'll get hungry and they'll get demonstrative. And I think parents of youngsters who've been in institutions have to be sensitive to that. But these are all things to work through at no particular great cost. And I think on the other side of it, there's a great flat field of normalcy.
Sure. Well, and that's another intriguing thing about your book is that not everything you write about is bolted securely and inexorably with adoption. I mean,
yeah.
Much of what you talk about is the reality of all parents. I mean, tantrums. You write at one point, children have tantrums whether they have been adopted from China, plucked from bulrushes, or born into the House of Windsor. And there's something kind of encouraging about that.
I think I even venture the guess that when the Dalai Lama was 4 years old, he probably had tantrums. You know what happens, though, and we want to, if we can, spare our daughters from this, and I hope maybe in writing a book like this, spare even more than just our daughters about this. You don't want people like seeing a 4-year-old kid who happens to be adopted throwing a tantrum and assume that it's adoption related. They're 4 years old. These things happen, you know. And I think it's interesting that, like Martin Simon, talk about in the book, the son of Paul Simon, a late senator from neighboring state of Illinois, and that's one of my favorite vignettes in the book. And Martin says, interestingly, as he was growing up, the fact of his adoption, he felt, was very liberating in that it allowed him to trace everything back to that fact. He didn't, if he was feeling anxious, if he was feeling confused, if he was going through the adolescent period of, oh, where do I fit into this world, he could trace that back to adoption. He had a peg on which to rest things. And he said he actually felt very grateful that way because he could figure it out through that prism.
That's one way in which this matter of one's own plot line.
Yeah, exactly. I think Steve Inskeep talks about that, too.
Right.
You know, Steve says as he was growing up, he was a kid with a lot of, I guess, what we call moxie, and was always joking and always making irreverent comments. And he told himself it was always because he was trying to make up for something having been adopted. Or as he said, at least that was my plot line. That was my narrative.
Right. So much of your book is tremendously positive and life-affirming and joyous. I do appreciate the fact that among the accounts that we read is that of Steve Sodkri, who was born in Italy and given up by his mother and a family that adopted him, essentially gave him back, dropped him off at the Angel Guardian Orphanage, setting him, you write, on, or he says, setting my brother and I on the counter, like some kind of delivery parcel and left them there.
Yeah.
And this reminds us of the reality that, I mean, that adoption is, it's never accidental. It is a deliberate choice, and in most cases, of course, a very loving choice that someone has made. This story reminds us of kind of the flip side of that, that in certain, thankfully rare occasions, we hope, it's sometimes a conscious decision or choice which someone tries to reverse.
Yeah, and I have known Steve for years, and I'm so grateful that he was willing to. I mean, I haven't weighed these things on a scale. He's got just about the most, I think, painful story in there. Although, as he keeps saying, you know, he was never in his mother's shoes, so he doesn't want to judge. This was in post-war Italy, and you know, his mother wasn't ready to have a family. Let's put it that way. And Steve is a wonderful guy, and he's just about the most active human being I know. He's a jeweler and vintage watch specialist in suburban Cleveland, Ohio. But he scuba dives, he paints, he takes award-winning photographs. I mean, he ranges around the world in kind of adventure travel. He's always busy. He's always moving. And he was adopted, and these people in Indiana, northwest Indiana, changed their minds. It was the sort of thing where they thought adopting a kid from post-war Italy sounded like a good thing to do. Steve wonders if they didn't do it to please their parish priest. And then faced with the reality of Steve and his little brother, Alphonse, they just decided against it. And they put them literally on the desk at the Angel Guardian Orphanage outside Chicago there in northwest Indiana. Now, this comes back to, as my wife says, there are no happy orphanages. Angel Guardian, and I'm old enough to remember when there used to be publicity about it, Angel Guardian was considered the Choate or Groton of orphanages. It was plentifully supported by the Archdiocese of Chicago. I don't mind saying it was the favorite charity of a lot of prominent Chicago mobsters. Steve still talks about the opulent Christmas parties that they had. You know, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin would entertain the kids at Angel Guardian. And they had plenty to eat. They had plenty of clothes. They had opportunities and advantages. I mean, it was truly considered a good thing to do for a child. And yet, you could read Steve's story and understand that it's still what happened to him still matters in his life. It still counts, no matter what he's achieved, no matter what he's earned. The hurt of that, there's still a sting in his life that he believes still affects him. I think he's much too hard on himself as to how it's affected his ability to be a good father. I think he's a great father. And by the way, I happen to know his daughters agree with me. But he talks about ways in which he thinks he's been emotionally closed off as a father, and he hates to do that because he loves his children very much. And I'm so glad that he consented to share his story, because on the one hand, it has a happy ending. This is a man of great accomplishments. This is a man who could be considered a poster child for the Angel Guardian Orphanage and for orphanages. On the other hand, you realize that there's certainly a deep hurt that's left in his life.
Sure.
And what I so admire about Steve is that he's kept on going. He decided a long time ago he wasn't going to let that kind of spent hurt prevent him from having the one life we're all ever going to have. And I think he's done remarkable things with his life, both professionally and personally.
The last word I wanted to leave with our listeners is from very late in the book, and it certainly has to resonate powerfully with the experience of you and your wife and your two daughters and with many families all around the world. You write, "Adoptive parents come to terms early with something every parent has to confront at some turn. Our love is not exclusive. Two
yeah.
other people gave our child life and perhaps a love as powerful as our own. They couldn't keep them, and in the end, no parent can. All parents have to cheerfully and tearfully accept that their children belong to the world."
Yeah, and I do think we adopting parents, whatever the term of art is, I think we often just have to come to terms with that a lot earlier, because we understand that someone who loved our children as powerfully as we do gave them up. And not because they didn't love them, but because of circumstances that prevented them from keeping them in their lives. So we begin with that fact. And yet, of course, any youngster growing up at some point will grow up and grow out of our embrace, grow out of our, not our love, certainly, but out of our house. And if we want them in our lives for the rest of our lives, if we want them to come back, if we want to remain a part of each other's lives, what we need are memories. What we need are things that knit us together, that love and that understanding. And it can't be dictated. It has to grow out of our mutual experience. And I think one of the, for lack of a better term, advantages adoptive families have is that we are inspired to utter things out loud to each other that maybe in other families they kind of assume. You know, yeah, of course, I love you. You're my daughter. Well, in adoptive families, I think we are inspired to talk to each other about what we mean to each other. And I think that can even give us a deeper bond, the deepest bond of all.
Sure. Important things do not go without saying, in other words.
Exactly, yeah.
The book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. In Praise of Adoption, it is published by Random House. Scott Simon, this has been a great pleasure and honor for me. Thank you so much, and thank you for writing this beautiful book.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with three representatives of a nonprofit organized 10 years ago to lift up the very important issue of suicide and suicide prevention. The organization is Just Live, and on the 1st of September, they're going to be presenting the Labor of Love Music Festival in New Munster. And we'll be talking with several members of Just Live, talking about why this issue means so much to them. Looking ahead to Monday's morning show, we'll actually continue with that important theme. You'll hear my conversation with best-selling author David Vaughn, who actually crafted a very powerful novel around the theme of suicide. Although it is a work of fiction, it is based heavily on his real-life experience of losing his own father to suicide. On Tuesday, we'll welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage. His monthly visit to The Morning Show, he will offer up his analysis of a plethora of current events and issues. On Wednesday, I'm hoping to present to you a conversation with Doug Instanis and Kim Instanis. Doug Instanis, of course, the Artistic Director of the Racine Theatre Guild. Kim Instanis is on the theater faculty at Carthage College and, as a matter of fact, is the most recent recipient of Carthage's Distinguished Teaching Award. I invited Doug and Kim to come on The Morning Show to talk about a really memorable trip which they recently took to Edinburgh, Scotland, to visit, among other things, the Fringe Festival, one of the largest and most important theatrical festivals in the world. And they will recount at least some of what they experienced during that memorable trip. A week from today, I'll be presenting a conversation with Eric Berry, who is the mandolin player and one of the charter members of the highly acclaimed bluegrass group Trampled by Turtles. And they are the headline group for the aforementioned Labor of Love Music Festival. And a week from tomorrow, a conversation about youth resistance to the Nazis in France during World War II. I'll talk with the author of a book called Sudden Courage. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. And we want to remind you that the morning show is also available now as a podcast, in which you can hear a different morning show 7 days a week. It's available on all the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast.